to an audio recording.
How's it going?
It wasn't working, so we're now late.
Delay before, actually.
Okay.
All right.
Well, so I guess without any further ado, let's welcome Heather Cruikshank to...
Thank you. Thank you. Sorry about that. Technical challenges. All right. I'm going to talk about the impact of climate change in the role of sort of international development is very much what I'm going to talk about. I work in the engineering department as a researcher, and my field of research really is international development and how engineers can contribute to that. So kind of worth knowing, how many engineers are here? How many of you are... Just one? Two? Okay. Cool. That's all right, because... I've got a sort of broader remit today than just the sort of engineering approach, but there's obviously lots of engineering examples. I'm a civil engineer, and I've worked in a number of countries delivering sort of infrastructure projects mostly, and got very involved in the kind of wider issues of development and the challenges that are going to face that in the future, of which climate change is obviously a big part of that. So this is what I said I was going to talk about. So the idea that climate change is going to cause local and regional changes, and that this is going to have an impact on the resources that are available to use, how we use them, how we access them, including the human resources. And that's a really big part of all of this, is the impact that that's going to have on the people on the ground, if you like. The implication that that's going to have towards development and moving the sort of international development field forward and allowing people to develop as they see fit is really important as well. So I'm going to look at the challenges. I'm going to make some suggestions based around the delivery of the Millennium Development Goals, really just as something to kind of frame the talk around. Some of them are more relevant than others to climate change impacts, but I don't have all the answers. If I did, there wouldn't be such a big problem. I think you could have solutions to these sort of things, and I'm really keen that this session and this day is about what you're going to do about things. It's not time for sort of more stating what the problems are. I think we're all aware that there are big problems out there. So it's more about what you're going to do about it. So I'm going to finish with some challenges to you as to what you're going to do and take forward from this. So what I'm going to do is give you a quick run through the eight Millennium Development Goals and some ideas about the kind of role that climate change can have impacting onto those, and then we'll open it up for discussion about the sort of wider issues, if that's okay with you, about sort of the things that you see as being important and importantly leading towards what you're going to do about it. All right. I work in a Centre for Sustainable Development, and that's often referred to in terms of sort of economic, social and environmental issues. That's kind of how sustainable development is often talked about. But a nicer way of phrasing it is that it's about people, planet and prosperity. And the most important one of those for me is the people. These are some kids that I was working with when I was working in Afghanistan. You get kids everywhere when you do infrastructure projects. They all want to come and help, which is nice. But the people are ultimately the most important thing, and it's perhaps a bit rare to hear an engineer saying that. We're not usually very good at talking to people at all. But I believe that this is what it's really all about. Engineers only exist to deliver, to meet needs for the people on the ground. So this is really important. So people first. The planet, so the environmental issues and the exploitation or conservation of the resources that we have available and what we're doing with them. And obviously the climate change impacts very strongly on this dimension, which has an effect on the people down the line. And prosperity, the chance that people have got to kind of do that development, to move themselves forward. I don't really believe in the idea that, you know, it's a case of pumping more money in. It's about capacity building. It's allowing people to sort of develop their own talents and to sort of move forward and develop themselves. So these are my little shoeshine entrepreneurs in Kabul. They're actually not using shoe polish in any kind of way. This is old engine oil, but it makes them kind of black and shiny, so it does the job. But, you know, this is a great entrepreneur. This is a young lad who's sort of going out and making money really for himself and for his family, which is a really sort of positive thing. Perhaps the type of work needs looking into, but there's definitely capacity there and the skills there that can be tapped into, and that's really important as well. So it's not a case of people in developing countries sitting and waiting for a handout. They're waiting for opportunities in some cases and need the capacity to go forward, and that's really important to solve their own problems. So, the Millennium Development Goals. I guess you're all pretty familiar with these. Is anybody not comfortable with these? Everybody happy? Okay. I'm going to just run through them as an example. There are eight Millennium Development Goals. These came out, unsurprisingly, in 2000. They were agreed as being sort of general targets that we were going for. The deadline on achieving these is mostly 2015, so we're a good way down delivering that. So from 2000 to 2015, we've got 15 years to deliver. We're halfway through it now. We're certainly not halfway through delivering really on any of these. So they're a goal to aim for. The danger with them is that if we don't achieve them, you know, what's going to happen after 2015 when we haven't achieved the goals? But they're certainly sort of very sensible ways forward. So these are the 8 Millennium Development Goals. I'm going to run through them. The presentation that I think is going to go on the website, aren't they? They're all going to go up on your site. It's got some links for some further information on them, but we're not going to go through the detail now. I'm just going to run through the sort of broad goals and the targets that go along with them. So they all make a lot of sense. They're all things that you kind of can't argue with. They're all things we should be working towards, and that's really important. But climate change is going to have an impact on, I would say, all of these to a greater or lesser extent. So, first one, eradicate extreme poverty and hunger. Seems perfectly sensible. There's a couple falling off the bottom there. That's because we're on a different computer, so I apologise for that. But, again, very sensible things. A lot of the targets in the Millennium Development Goals refer to sort of halving the proportion of people, and that's really important when you think about population increase. I'll come back to that later in terms of what that sort of means in delivery terms. But halving the proportion of people that are suffering from various things, like people's income is less than $1 a day. This is a really fundamental indicator of how able people are to sort of move themselves forward. So if you're in a very poor environment, it's very difficult to develop. And there can be big impacts on that. But I've got some questions about why do we use $1 a day? Everybody refers to this kind of $1 a day or $2 a day. It's very sort of widely referred to. But whether it sort of really means anything, you know, is open to debate a little bit. And how do we sort of go about identifying what an appropriate indicator of economic poverty is really important as well. It is an indicator. It's just one of the things that's used to sort of highlight the issues. There are always exceptions to indicators like that. So you can get somebody who has a very low income but a very good quality of life. But also you get people who have a very high income and a very poor quality of life. You know, it's not true that it's just a case of extra money. There's been some really interesting work done in the Judge Business School here about trying to establish an ethical poverty line. So this is one of the papers that came out. So this is the $1 a day level, and that's the $2 a day level, basically. But what this graph is really showing is that you've got a lot of people on a low income and a very low sort of consumption level. So that's the bottom line there. And then a very few people on a very high income and a very large consumption. But the impact of the people consuming a lot, you know, impacts on the people who have a low income. So, and if you move it to a sort of $2 a day, we're basically including an awful lot more people in the area under that graph, really. So are we looking at the right kind of things? What's the indicator that, or what's the impact coming out from that indicator of economic activity? And attached to that kind of work is this issue. This is plotting your life expectancy, which is kind of quite a good indicator of how well everything is going in your life. If you have poor health and poor opportunities and low income, you're likely to have a fairly low life expectancy. And that's your life expectancy at birth. So if you're born now in that country, what age are you expected to live to? And then this is your sort of income along the bottom, sort of GDP per capita. And what this really shows is that you need a certain amount of income to get to a certain level of health and life expectancy. But after that, you're really not really making a huge amount of difference with that extra income. So this is the kind of tipping point here. And you can see the kind of countries that are on that. India and China are kind of on that sort of tipping point. So below that level, you do need a certain amount of money to just kind of raise your life chances. But above that, it isn't really making a whole lot of difference. You're not really adding much impact for that extra income. So that's just a kind of aside. And obviously, how you sort of use that income becomes very important as well. And what a lot of income ends up being for is helping people to eat, basically. I do a challenge with my graduate class where they take it on to a lesser or greater enthusiasm, but I ask them to live on £1 a day for a week. And there's no other rules than that. Here, that's it. That's the challenge. And they come back a week later, and they're all obsessed with food and how they manage to eat for the week. And there's obviously lots of other externalities in that, and how how you account in for that, that, you know, oh, well, I didn't actually count in the cost of the bike that I used to get to college. Oh, and I didn't count in that I had to pay my rent last month. Oh, and I didn't count in, you know, the computer that I was using that I've already got. Oh, and the electricity for the lighting. Oh, and all the other things. So when you're really on the edge of things, the food becomes absolutely critical. And a lot of people are in this kind of subsistence bracket. And this is where the climate change issue comes in, because this is going to be very, very impacted. These people who are on the subsistence level are going to be massively impacted by climate change issues and changes in their local environment. So a lot of very poor areas of the world, these are the sort of two main staple crops in a lot of places. So this is wheat and rice. In some places you get them grown together, so this has been a wheat field that's been harvested and then it's been turned into a rice field as a sort of second crop, and this is very common. In the background you can see the animals as well, and that's another impact. They take a lot of resources to keep animals, so water resources and space and land availability, as well as the biomass that they consume themselves. So in very poor areas, you're on this very sort of staple diet, and this is obviously going to be very impacted by climate change. I've got a particular interest in sort of water resources and water management, and that's obviously a big issue that's going to be altered by climate change down the line. Changing patterns, changing precipitation patterns, and changing resource availability is going to have a big impact on what you can actually grow. These are very poor people. They're very dependent on the success of the crops year on year. All you need is a run of you know, slightly different kind of climate for a few growing seasons and you can be in a real crisis situation. They haven't got the capacity, or they haven't got the money really available to be carrying stores forward. There are lots of issues about how you store food as well year on year. But they're very dependent on the natural cycles, and that can have a really massive impact on their survivability, really. If you get a couple of bad years, that can you know, literally be wiping out communities, really, which is pretty hazardous. Things like rice, this is a rice field, like I say, take massive amounts of resources in themselves. For the amount of product that's produced in a rice field, you need a huge water input. And that's one of the things that's very, like I say, susceptible to change in climate change. And a lot of the regions that are very dependent on this, and a lot of the regions that were in that very poor bracket, the first sort of axis of that graph that I just showed you, are in areas where they're dependent on this kind of food, and also in areas where they're very vulnerable to climate change. An indication of the kind of water that gets used in very arid areas in a lot of places as well, so that can be a problem. There's also the knock-on impact of when natural disasters impact on a country. This is actually following the Indian Ocean tsunami, which is not a climate-related issue, but it's certainly an indication of a natural disaster affecting an area's ability to sort of feed itself. And then you get into the issue where you're having to bring in kind of food aid, and that's transferring food from one country to another in a lot of places, or certainly for different areas in a region. And that can have big impacts as well. So it can be a sort of secondary impact down the line, rather than just you not being able to sort of grow your own food. Getting into the situation where you need food aid makes populations very vulnerable to lots of other influences as well. So you get lots of nice NGOs there bringing in food and supplies, and that's kind of great. But you also have knock-on impacts in terms of who you have to work with. So this was the local army that we were working with, who were very nicely guarding the food aid at that point. But you know, you've got to negotiate with them. You can't keep yourself out of negotiating with these kind of groups. And so impacts of people down the line get very complex, and you get involved with lots of other issues that you maybe didn't think you were likely to. I've had to work with a lot of people like this. You know, as an engineer, you have to engage with the local structure, and the military and the unofficial military as well in a lot of places can be one of those elements. So you're impacting them all the way down the line. All right, achieving universal primary education. How is this linked to climate change? Well, there's issues about trying to, again, this is the target for this, so trying to get boys and girls to schooling. If there are issues that are caused by that poor family sort of needing to put in more labour to produce the food that they need to feed themselves, then, you know, you end up with sort of child labour going into just basic running of the household, and that can be really damaging for children's education. There are also issues about, you know, providing food for the children themselves, and it's also linked back to the food and hunger one. big population increases in a lot of places, so the demand for schooling is also on the up, so the pressures on that sort of system are there as well, and how that can be accommodated is a big issue down the line, because this is really planning for the future. If you're not getting education at this age, then the chances for development down the line are severely compromised. And in a lot of cases, the demand for schooling is increasing at such a rate that, you know, formal schools aren't in existence at the moment, so you end up with temporary schools, which, you know, the quality of education you get in these places is a bit compromised as well. And what happens a lot in places like this, again, very poor areas where you're in the kind of subsistence farming type of region, then the children will all disappear out of the schools when the harvest needs to be brought in, so they're having a sort of disjointed education system as well. Obviously, it can work really nicely, and there can be good opportunities to sort of teach wider issues as well, including the issues about resource management that are, you know, are going to allow people to be able to cope with sort of climate change issues down the line. So this again is Afghanistan, where the green revolution has really just kind of taken hold. So, you know, grow more fertilizer, more of everything. They grow pretty good poppies, you've probably heard. But in terms of growing food and other useful cash crops that are perhaps more legal, poppies are pretty good cash crop, I have to say. But, you know, that comes down to education as well. So how do you kind of reach people if they're not in school? You can't reach them to sort of make them aware of these kind of issues and the changing issues. They're very much sort of trapped in the 1970s view of the world because they haven't had the education to move that forward. So that's really important as well in terms of helping them to cope. Education is often an issue that's addressed by this goal, so promoting gender equity and empowering women. And the first target in that goal is about getting girls into schools, basically. This is a sort of major target. It's a very sort of difficult thing to facilitate because there are so many other things that get in the way of it. So, again, in a very labour-based economy, girls and women are often sort of taken out of the education opportunity because they're needed to sort of do very manual labour to keep the household going. So that can be a problem as well. And you see the note there, note 11, about trying to get women out of the sort of agricultural sectors to stop them doing that very, very menial work that's stopping them getting wider opportunities is very important as well. So there you go, getting girls into school is a big issue in a lot of places. And again, girls understanding or women having a better understanding of resource issues can help to sort of more efficiently manage a household, which is generally it's the women that are in charge of that. So again, education out of those kind of issues can have a big impact on the coping mechanism, allowing them to sort of cope with climate changes down the line. That leads us on to reducing child mortality. Like I say, if you're in a sort of poor environment, you've got poor resources and other challenges, then one of the indicators is a high level of child mortality. So again, we're talking about, you know, reducing by a proportion the number of children that are dying. It's usually a sort of newborns rate, so the amount of, you know, absolutely death at birth cases. But then the other indicator is this under five. So you've managed to actually survive being born, but then, you know, what happens in the first 5 years? Children are pretty vulnerable at that age, and the infant mortality rates can be pretty high in a lot of developing countries. So, this is a question for you, just to make sure you're awake. What do you think is the leading cause of death in children under the age of five?
Dehydration.
Dehydration caused by what? Or?
Things like diarrhea.
Yep. Okay, diarrhea is a big killer, but it's not the worst at the moment.
Malnutrition,
yeah, linked back to the food issues that I was talking about before, but it's not the worst.
Malaria,
okay. I'm going to come on to malaria later because that's another climate change related disease. We'll come on to that, but it's not the worst.
It's pneumonia.
Getting closer. No, it's not pneumonia. TB? That's another, I can see where that came from then, but... another disease. We'll come on to diseases in a minute. It's actually... acute respiratory infection, and this is in a lot of cases due to poor indoor air quality, so there's a big drive towards that. But dehydration from diarrhea is a big big issue in a lot of places, it's just been overtaken by this as the child killer. The reason being, the diarrhea doesn't kill you, it's the dehydration that kills you. And there's been better recognition of an understanding of that being the problem. So treatment of diarrhea has got better in recent years. So you're less likely to die of it, but it does make you pretty ill for an awful lot of the time. And in countries where you've sort of got water shortages, then the quality of water is often pretty bad as well, and that can lead you into sort of problems with diarrhea. But at the moment, it's respiratory infections. So if you've got, and this is the climate change link, is that if you've got an area that's becoming deforested, or it's sort of reducing its biocapacity, or you're having to spread out agricultural areas to sort of feed a growing population, where land is becoming degraded or rainfall patterns are changing and you're having to expand out, then you've not got kind of wood fuel for burning. So what gets used is this. Can you see what that is? That this little girl's carrying? Any suggestions?
Absolutely.
Very widely used in a lot of places. Don't get the idea that this is a non-technical thing. This is very engineered, which I kind of like. So this is the dung being dried into pats, which is also probably increasing your risk of getting those diarrheal diseases because you're kind of handling their stuff, which isn't usually the best. They usually have a bit of camprint in the middle of them, these, which is quite nice. They're sort of stuck on the side and burned. But very sort of low-quality fuel, really, for in the houses. You've also got the knock-on effect of you're reducing the fertiliser input into the land that you've got available, so your land is then becoming sort of less productive as well down the line, which means you need to take more land, which probably means you're deforesting even further. So again, the knock-on effects kind of go on from this. So that's the biggest killer, but there's certainly lots of other things that are making children sick for a long time, and adults sick as well in a lot of these places. Which leads us on to improving maternal health. The aim is to reduce maternal mortality ratio. Again, it's another of these kind of indicators, really, to give you an impression of what's happening deeper down. But the idea of having, you know, skilled health workers sort of getting out to places is really important for improving the chances of you surviving having the children in the first place. And in a lot of developing countries, again, where productivity is dependent on labour, then, you know, having more children is going to help you to sort of move that forward. So having more children then puts you more at risk of maternal mortality. Obviously, the more times you have children, the more chance you've got of dying of it. And these can be sort of, you know, big knock-on issues down the line throughout the family as well. How effective is that kind of family being to sort of cope with its own development and take itself forward? So this is sort of three generations in one family. All right, the general kind of health issues associated with that are caught in the goal six as well. So there's been lots of health issues throughout the other goals as well, and they're all sort of caught in this one. So other diseases like TB, HIV/AIDS is a big challenge at the moment, and it's the main sort of first target on those. So there's an awful lot of notes go along with this, but trying to sort of reduce the spread of AIDS down the line is very important. One of the things with the spread of AIDS is that in a lot of cases it's been seen to have been transferred sort of through major sort of population movement routes. So a lot of the kind of main trunk roads have a high prevalence of HIV/AIDS along the side of them. So people kind of moving around a region start to cause that disease, and other diseases can be transferred to different populations. And the climate change impact of that is, if your area is changing because of climate change and you end up having to move on to a different area, then you're getting these kind of population movements, and you're perhaps getting communities that haven't previously been in contact with each other, don't have resilience to each other, and then you're getting spread of diseases, including HIV and AIDS, through these sort of people movement routes, and that's pretty prevalent in all parts of the world where you get large bodies of people moving along. So issues about kind of environmental refugees, so people having to move because their land has become unproductive for them, or that they're at risk from natural disasters or increasing natural disasters caused by climate changes, means that you're getting this flow of movement of people, which is leading to the diseases being spread further than previously. Malaria is another one that's obviously linked to climate change. There's a lot of evidence that a lot of major cities in the world were built in a location which is usually at an elevation higher than malaria was going to be prevalent. So places like Islamabad are built kind of partway up the hillside, which keeps them in a cool enough region that you don't get kind of malaria developing. As climate change is causing changes in these places, there's evidence that malaria is becoming more prevalent in places that previously not sort of suffered from it. So major conurbations like Islamabad are now becoming vulnerable to malaria, whereas that was previously sort of constrained to the sort of coastal areas a bit more, and lowland areas were more sort of susceptible to it. So big changes happening in kind of subtle ways. Incidence of malaria is pretty widespread. It can be a killer in a lot of countries. So, you know, you can have your vaccinations and your tablets to stop you getting it, which means you can survive it, you'll still get it, but you can live through it. If you're in a very sort of poor community, you're not going to have access to that, and people, you know, are still dying of malaria in a lot of places. It's also that spread of people, that movement of people, is allowing different strains of it to spread around, so the resilience is not being sort of built up, and that can make people very vulnerable as well. And other major diseases, yeah, it mentioned sort of TB before, and they're also spread by vectors in a lot of places. So, you know, again, climate changes are allowing those vectors to move around as well and making people more susceptible to a range of diseases. All right, environmental sustainability is where I guess I do most of my work, because that's got the targets on water and sanitation that I'm going to come on to. But there's also this issue about reducing the loss of environmental resources, and that's, you know, things like forest cover, it's biodiversity, it's things that are going to be very majorly impacted by climate changes down the line. So this one very much sort of feeds into this. And then some of the things that we're kind of, you know, bothering ourselves about here is the kind of, you know, CO2 emissions, the energy issues. But these are all relevant to developing countries as well. They're going to have to move forward. And the way that they use their resources is very important. And if those resources become degraded, natural resources become degraded, then the chance of development is compromised as well. This is just a little overview of what that means. You probably, who's come across eco-footprinting before? That's going to go slow. Yeah. All right. Oops. Yeah, I was going to just go through that quickly. Oh, we're going a bit slow here. Sorry about that. The idea of eco-footprinting is that there's a fair share of productive land on the planet. Oops. My footprints aren't coming up. Never mind. Sorry about that. And what this is sort of capturing is, you know, the land needed to grow food, the land for energy production, sort of general infrastructure issues at the bottom as well. So how much is being taken to actually keep you sort of moving forward? And we're already using more than the fair share as an average. What that means is if everybody used the average amount, we'd need more than one planet, basically. That's my footprint have come up now. So some countries obviously use a massive amount more. It's quite tempting for us to sort of look to the North America and say, well, they're worse than we are, but we're pretty bad on global terms as well. If you're in Sierra Leone, we don't look a whole lot different than anybody else. So it's not a case of being able to say, you know, well, they're doing it worse. What, of course, happens is a lot of countries down at the bottom end up using very little of the global resources, because we're importing a lot of resources from all over the world, which increases our eco-footprint. But as an average, the world is using too much already. So, yes, biocapacity increases in some places and in some ways, but climate change is also sort of making that a bit more of a complex sort of prediction in terms of how productive places are going to be in the future. And you've probably seen these kind of things before. We're only going to get one. That's not what it's supposed to be. Okay, that was to show that we would need more Earths than we have available, obviously. It's ridiculous to say that we need 5 Earths to support our lifestyle. This is if everybody on the planet was living the lifestyle that we have in the UK. So again, it's easy to sort of blame other people as being worse, but it doesn't matter. When you've passed one, it's too much, so we've still got to do something about it. And this is sort of tapping into the idea that resources are changing as a result of climate change, so your water resource is likely to alter. Demands are increasing because of various different sort of knock-on impacts, and we just haven't got enough basically to go around. So we've got to do something about it. So in the West, we need to reduce to allow people in developing countries to sort of have more of their fair share. All right, this is what I spend a lot of time working on, so providing safe drinking water and sanitation. which is a really important factor in a lot of countries as well. So again, the climate change impact on this is changes to these water resources in a lot of places. Populations are increasing all over the world, really, except for a very few exceptions. So the demands are increasing, the demand for food is increasing, the demand for drinking water is increasing, and you know, there's only a finite amount of these resources. So yes, we can do nice projects to make people look happy down the line. We need to shorten the
I think we have about 15 minutes to the end of the session.
Fine.
So since we wanted to allow for some questions, so
okay, that's fine. I'm all set.
All right, 5 minutes or so.
No problem. All right, so we can do very practical projects, but you've only got a finite amount of resource available. So things like solutions that have worked in the past. This is direct action pump lifting water up straight out of the aquifer, effectively straight out of the water table. Sorry, I should say. These start to kind of not be productive as climate change sort of has an impact and demands have an impact as well. So you can't end up using the original technologies. We have to look to other things. So this is a rainwater harvesting scheme to try and kind of get you through those dry periods to sort of store water, to catch water, and access the resources in different ways, which is really important. As I said about at the beginning about the Millennium Goals are often referred to halving the proportion of people without. This is just an indicator that says, okay, in 1990 this was the global population, this was the people without access to water, which was about 1 billion. In 2000, when the Millennium Development Goals were set, okay, population had increased, we've still got about 1 billion, and that was after 10 years of trying to provide water to everybody, so that worked. If we look at the 2015 target, okay, it depends what you have as your sort of global population prediction. But even if we achieve the target, so we reduce the proportion back to 1990 levels, which is what the Millennium Goals refer to, you've still got about 1 billion. So if you're in that billion at the bottom, you're still in a pretty bad state. So the goals are a good way to be going forward, but they're certainly not the only answer or the ultimate answer either. Whoops. Interesting. Okay, and then even if we're looking at what we're actually delivering in terms of the Millennium Development Goals, what happens with things like the water and sanitation targets is this will be counted as an improved water source. This is a hand pump, and this is, you know, the kind of things that we're heading towards, and this will be counted as an improved water source. So you count how many of these there are, multiply it by the number of people you think are using it, and that's how many people have access. Would you drink out of this tap? Hand pump? Who would drink out of this? Brave man. I usually do, but I probably wouldn't with this one. This is pretty bad in engineering terms. You've got a lot of standing water and contamination, and it's all leaking in the top, and it's probably pretty nasty, but, you know. That would count as an improved water source as far as the goals are concerned. So be very wary when you hear about sort of reaching the targets of the Millennium Goals. It can be pretty subjective, really. The other one is sanitation. Again, as climate change changes the sort of local climate conditions, the local weather conditions, then sanitation can become a real big issue. Obviously, you know, these are sort of Dalek toilet blocks in South Africa, and on a hot day, they're going to be pretty ripe, really. So, you know, your sanitation system becomes very important, particularly if the temperature is increasing. You really don't want to be standing next to those on a hot day. So we need to think of more innovative ways of delivering that. So open sanitation becomes a very hazardous thing in hot countries. And then also in places where, again, the precipitation pattern might be changing and it's washing all that sand and all that fecal matter into your drinking sources or into the streets, that can become a big problem as well. So we need to think a bit more innovatively. And then improving the chances of slum dwellers sort of captures all of these kind of issues. So the water, the sanitation, the food production, the eco-footprint issues, the general sort of life, quality of life issues, all get caught in that slum target. And thinking about more innovative ways to go forward, and perhaps tapping into the opportunities presented by climate change as well. In some places, you know, PV is actually going to become more viable because of the changes to the local weather patterns. So that can be a good thing. But waste, like the sanitation issue, is another one that becomes very, very pertinent as you start to change things like water levels, precipitation levels, and general sort of local issues. So the final goal then is this idea of developing partnerships, and this, I guess, is kind of where you sort of start to come in today's sort of how do we go forward with this. A lot of partnerships are going to be really required. There's quite a lot of targets along with these. I'll leave these so you've got them on the website, but They're all sort of very, very sensible sounding things. But really what it's about is tapping into that kind of capacity, local capacity, and allowing people to sort of develop forward in a way that suits them best. So that's from the Shoeshine Boys. And the little girl carrying her fuel for the family, really, as well. Alright, so what we're trying to aim for is trying to improve people's standard of living, help them sort of get better education and help to feed into that long and healthy life. And climate change is going to impact, hopefully I've demonstrated, so that's going to impact on all of those really down the line. This is the Human Development Index that basically is the indicator of how well you're doing. So the countries that are doing really well are all the nice cosy ones in kind of Europe and the West and Japan down there as well. You know, the really highly developed countries that are doing okay. And the ones that are doing really badly, and there's more off the bottom that aren't actually rated. But these are the kind of places that ironically are possibly going to be the worst hit by climate change as well. The most drastic climate change is going to happen in these places. So how are they going to respond to that? All right, so what I've covered then, and now we'll go on to the discussion, is some ideas of what's going to be affected by climate change in the future. So issues to do with poverty, food security, education, to a lesser extent perhaps, but secondarily impacted by climate change, inequality, health issues, definitely, unsustainable resource use and degradation of resources. Whoops. And to answer that, we need to need more partnerships to move us forward. So my questions to you for the discussion, I guess, is what are we going to do about it? So what does it mean for you? What are you going to do on your daily life to make things better? What are you going to do in your profession? You know, I as an engineer can do a sort of certain amount of things, and I know that I can influence my profession to sort of take climate change and development issues more seriously. What about the organisation where you're working? It has to kind of start at home as well. It's no good saying it's, you know, for somebody else over there to worry about. We've got to do our own things. What practical actions will you take? I guess this is what you're going to do this afternoon, is committing to what you are going to do. And, you know, what are we waiting for? We've got the technology. We've got the knowledge of what we need to do. Do we have the will to take action, really? So those are my questions to you. What are you going to do?
All right, well, thanks for...
Over to you. I need answers.
So do you want to answer or do you want to question? That's the good question to start. Anyways, contributions, please.
What can we do to impact on these development issues, really, is what I'm asking.
Can I just ask... That's not quite answering that, but giving us something to think about for that. Listening to the presentation and the focus on the Millennium Development Goals, and the whole way we think of sustainable development is something that's tied up with the issue of poverty. You know, how do you feel about the fact that there is a whole sort of worldview and discourse around being responsible and sustainable and helping people to get out of poverty, which is actually very effective in closing out the second half of the graphs that you put up earlier about the massive scale of overconsumption that is in the developed world.
Absolutely. I would say, I do more than just the poverty end of things. I mean, absolutely, it's about us as well. And that's what I was trying to indicate with the sort of eco-footprinting end of it, is it's not a case of just saying, you know, if we put more money in, we can bring the developed countries up. We've also got to reduce our use, our, you know, consumption, absolutely, down the line. It's just beyond what's sensible. And that's a really difficult thing for people to catch on to. It's the problem with sustainable development and the definitions that are used for it is they often talk about kind of future issues and poor people and other people over there, and it's all about kind of, you know, it's somebody else's issue. What we're very bad at doing is the here and now, and some of the kind of, you know, current problems and the current inequities. It's not just a case of bringing people up, we've got to reduce as well. But people are very uncomfortable about that when you say, which is what the point of these is what are you going to do about it? What are you going to cut out? What are you going to reduce your impact? You know, how are we going to tread more lightly so that the poor people in developing countries can, you know, improve their lot and have, you know, a longer life expectancy? People are dying, you know, at 40 in places. I mean, that just isn't right, and we're over consuming to a massive degree, and there's, you know, per capita we're having a massive impact in developed Western countries, really, and, you know, it's just not a fair share, even approximately. So absolutely, we have to reduce as well to kind of balance that out. And there's more to be done there, and I do other things on this slide.
look out for some more questions.
Comments. What are you going to do?
Heather, can I just say, with there seems to be a lot of kind of targets being set, especially internationally, and you're obviously talking about what we need to do today and take our personal responsibility, but do you think that these targets are sometimes unhelpful because we never actually reach them? We don't even get halfway, you're kind of demonstrating that. So what it does, it kind of takes the emphasis of the individual. So yeah. Normal, don't worry, things are going on, things are ticking on, never actually reach the target, and by which time it's, you could have actually spent 15 years of encouraging individual action.
Absolutely.
And getting stuck in.
Yeah.
Do you find things like Millennium Goals a little bit of a red herring?
Yeah, very much. They can be very unhelpful, actually, in a lot of ways, because of this, again, this kind of future idea that, you know, we're halfway down them, we're nowhere near halfway delivering them. You know, we're probably not, you know, people who are looking at them, we're probably not going to deliver on most of them. But then, you know, it's still a comfortable enough way away, you know, oh, but by 2015, we'll have come up with a great solution to all of that. And yeah, it stops people thinking about it today. So they can really be a hindrance. And like I tried to say at the beginning, you know, what happens when we don't? What are we going to do in 2016 when we realise we haven't delivered on these? How do you keep people's enthusiasm going? At the moment, they're a target and you can do projects that are leading towards the Millennium Development Goals. Yeah. But when we haven't achieved them, what do we do next? I mean, with the water and sanitation stuff that I do a lot of, there was a whole decade of water and sanitation in from 81 to 84, and that was supposed to be providing water and sanitation for everybody. And then the Millennium Development Goals come out in 2000 and say, oh, we're going to halve the proportion of people that don't have it. So we hadn't delivered, not even close. So, you know, how do you get that enthusiasm going again afterwards? So they can really be a hindrance, definitely. And I think there'll be a big problem in 2016 when we haven't done
it. What's the alternative? If you don't have targets for people to aim at, then people aim at all.
Exactly. They're a good thing in that, you know, it's focusing people's attention and, you know, perhaps it's raising awareness of these issues. Those kind of 8 goals are all perfectly sensible. They're all things that, you know,
they're permanent targets. I mean, there should be things that we aim for, not between 2000 and 2015.
Yeah, I mean, the goals should be. Yeah, the goals should be, you know, the goals of the high level eradicate poverty, you know, which is kind of a big issue. So the targets are to give you something a bit more achievable that you can kind of aim for specifically. So yeah, they're good for raising awareness. And like I say, there's a lot of talk about them. I mean, there's lots of talk, you know, you're all very involved in this and you're all very kind of tuned into it. But the man on the street, you know, it's easy stuff for people to get hold of. So it's useful in that way. But the alternative is just what you're doing today, really, trying to sort of say, what about the action now? What are you going to do today when you leave here that's different, that's going to help towards this? Because we've got to make these changes, and it's not going to be, you know, well, I'll make change in 2014, ready for 2015. You know, we've got to do them now, we've got to do it today, and we've got to do it individually.
Christine?
What do you think about sort of the problems that arise at something that's kind of sizing every day when the actions that you need to take to bring yourself down to one pilot, so like buying local instead of buying imported food, maybe conflict with at least like current models of development which are based on export-led growth and economies which basically rely on exporting bananas or whatever in order to grow. And it doesn't seem to me that there is any kind of credible alternative model that I've seen of kind of how to bring people out of poverty. We just suddenly stop buying imported goods, which obviously we do need to do in order to be sustainable.
Perhaps a bit into your stuff that you're going to hear about in the next session. But, I mean, absolutely, the more knowledge you have, the more difficult it gets to make those decisions. And, yeah, going shopping can be pretty difficult, actually. And you're right that it's not a simple solution. And I think when I get really nervous is when people say, well, this is the one thing that you should do, and then, you know, then you carry on doing everything else as you were, which I think was what was the topic of the previous discussion of it as well. You know, but what we try and sort of say to the students that take our course is not sort of necessarily having the answer. There isn't always an answer to things, or there often isn't one answer, but it's asking the better questions. So you're right, you know, the questions that you just raised there, if I buy this instead of that, what impact is that having down the line? And it's the education and the knowledge about what those impacts are is really important, and then you can start to make better judgment decisions on what you're actually doing individually. But there isn't one answer. I can't say if you do this and this, save the world, because it doesn't work like that. But you are at least aware of the issues, and then you have to decide what your priorities are and what you're tapping into. You know, are you interested in fair trade, or are you interested in water shortages, or are you interested in reducing your carbon footprint? You know, they'll give you different answers depending on what your priority is.
Thank you.
another question, maybe the last one.
I think we need to be really careful in how we perceive our economic relationship with the third world and how we articulate consumption as a really important form of positive action we can take. And I don't necessarily see the economic relationship that we have between ourselves and the third world as really something that is conducive to development. And I don't think that sort of, for instance, whether it might be stopping by bananas. But I think we need to sort of have an awareness that sometimes what we consume doesn't end up giving an economy to an area by consuming from it isn't necessary development, because what it stops is a community being too far for something to conserve. It's not the only model that it should be able to pretend.
Okay. I think that's the crux of it, so thank you for summing that up so much. I think that's the point, is understanding what the impacts are down the line, and certainly, you know, I feel very uncomfortable about kind of Western countries generally, you know, telling the developing world what they should do, because we evidently haven't got it right. You know, we've stuffed up our own sort of development path, so, you know, we really should be telling other people what to do. But tapping into what the possibilities are and what the capacities are and the limitations are is really important, and that's where we should be putting our energies.
Thanks a lot for the presentation and
thank you
for the questions. So I think it's a very important note that we are looking for this kind of systemic changes. So oftentimes as individuals we can't really affect things much, but we can try to visualize systems and try to come up with a new vision that we can propose for the relationship between the developed and the developing world.
And I'm
sure we're going to have more discussion about that.
Yeah, in the next session you're going to get a tool to help you do that, to help you make these decisions.
So I know we've been called to order to the reporting session, so we have to wrap up.